All right, here we are, The Matthew Aaron Show, www.thematthewaaronshow.com. You can follow us on Twitter, at Matt Aaron Show. Go to Facebook, type in The Matthew Aaron Show. You click like, and you will get all our updates, all the shows coming up. Pat Tobias handles all that. So if you want to send any questions or any requests, my producer, Pat, will take care of that. And if you want to catch up on any of our previous 285 podcasts, with guests such as Michael Whitehorn and Peter Tolan and Alan Loeb, who we had on this week, or some of our newer guests like Mark Pellington and Rachel Axler, you can go download it now. I was just telling Michael and Bruce that it's been weird because the podcast numbers, when you do a podcast, I don't know if anyone's interested in this, but you have a certain number of people that
go
listen.
For it.
Yeah, there's a certain number of people that listen to you immediately, like the minute you post right. the show or the day you post the show. And then throughout time, because you can log these things, people go back. So if they search Michael Whitehorn, one of the top 20 or so searches because of how many listens the podcast had when Mike was on will be Michael. And then you can listen to the podcast with Michael. So what's been different is, like, for instance, Hulk Hogan. We had thousands of people that listened. And now that podcast alone from thousands is up to like 300,000 listens. Wow. Now it's like a ton of people are listening up front. And I think it's the self-isolation that's going on. I think people are, I think our plan of giving people some content is working because I'm getting a lot of good numbers out of the gate, which is, you know, it's not always immediate. And so that's just an interesting little thing about podcasting. I'm sure everyone listens to Mark Maron up front. We get the back orders. So, so how you doing?
Not tonight.
Well, we only like it.
Go ahead, guys.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's going to be a crowded room. Go ahead, Mike. Michael Whitehorn's joining us. Of course, you all know Michael Whitehorn is the creator of King of Queens. He also wrote for Family Ties. Cheers, I believe, was your first break. I think we've talked about it. I don't know if it was your first break, but it was like one of the first two or three things you did. And funny enough, we were talking about Ken Levine yesterday. And I'm also here with Bruce Fretz, who you may remember, he was the TV guy at Entertainment Weekly and then TV Guide, and now he's at Closer Magazine and the New York Times. The New York Times, he just put out an interview with Modern Family creators Steve Levitan and Chris Lloyd today. And then Hillary Barriford, my producing partner, also is joining us. So we have a very good panel here, except none of us can see each other. So if there's a little interruptedness going on, please hang in there with us. I refuse to do Zoom because no one wants to look at me for an hour. So but I'm very happy to have Michael. I was bringing up Ken Levine because yesterday Peter Tolan and I spoke with Hillary as well. And, Peter wanted, first of all, to say hello to you, Michael. He hasn't seen you in years, and he misses you, and he says he sends very, very big regards. He's a huge fan of yours. And we were talking about...
Mutual.
Yeah. I'll send the message to him. He would love to catch up with you. And then this will be interesting to Bruce, I'm sure, for certainly. I guess Ken Levine put out a post the other day on his blog where he talked about how no great shows came out of 9/11. And of course he was referring to the coronavirus. Ooh. And Peter, I guess, was reading the blog. And Peter kept waiting for someone to be like, except that one great show, Rescue Me. And I guess it never happened. And it got us talking about, and I'm always curious what Mike thinks of what's going on in the business. And Bruce, I'm interested in your take on what's happening here, too, because Hillary and I already discussed it. But is there be a great show that comes out of this themed around the coronavirus or that at least acknowledges this period of time we went through?
Well, when I was talking to... go ahead, Michael.
Michael, you go first, then Bruce will go.
Well, I was...
You know, it's funny. I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday. You know, I think it's like that's like a sub question of a larger question because you know the coronavirus is the front and center kind of problem we have now, but there are equally horrifying existential, you know, things looming at our door that just aren't quite as you know demanding our attention at this very moment. And so, you know, increasingly I'm thinking, what are comedies going to look like in the years to come? Because, I mean, the networks don't give a shit. They don't even try to sort of set shows in an emotionally real place for real people in a contemporary setting. But streaming comedies presumably are trying to be smarter and more, you know, and go deeper. And how is the world we live in and the way it's sort of disintegrated going to manifest itself in comedy shows? And I think the coronavirus is sort of now, at this moment, the obvious thing to deal with. And yeah, there'll be 100 pitches about, you know, so locked in isolation with his ex-wife, you know, whatever. But I just think the only way you can deal with that comedically at this point is very superficially, because, you know, like anything, it just takes a while for an experience, especially like a cataclysmic experience like this, to sink it as a writer, you know, to sink into your bones and then come out again as product. You know, it's not something you just kind of dash off. So I don't know. And there are going to be a lot of them, but how do you make it funny? Someone will hit it. Someone will figure it out. But it's not easy.
No, Bruce, what have you?
You were ahead of the curve, Michael, with Weird Loners a few years ago. You were... appreciate that.
I know, yeah.
We're all Weird Loners now.
Bruce, what have you been hearing?
So weird. It is weird.
Well, when I was talking to Christopher Lloyd yesterday, he was saying, you know, on the one hand, he was happy that they had filmed the Modern Family finale, you know, right before the coronavirus hit, because they wouldn't have been able to do that last episode. But, you know, they did the big group hug, sort of take off on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was a great inside joke because Christopher Lloyd's dad, David Lloyd, wrote the Mary Tyler Moore Show, co-wrote the Mary Tyler Moore Show finale. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't have done that. So he was kind of saying, in a way, it's good that we got it done. On the other hand, he wished he could do one more episode because he would love to do a coronavirus episode.
Yeah.
But he said he knows every comedy writer is going to do that. So he thinks by the time he would get around to it on a new show, it's going to be, you know, stale material at that point. So, but I bet, you know, once comedy shows go back into production, everyone's going to do their take on it.
Yeah.
Mm.
And even when it becomes stale, there'll still be fresh disasters, I think.
Yeah.
comic material.
Yeah, that's my thing. I wonder if anyone's even going to be interested in it. I know, and we talked about this all week, and I've been kind of bouncing back and forth on it. But because on one hand, all these disaster movies like Contagion are trending extremely well and doing huge numbers. But on the other hand, I think when this is over, I don't know if anyone's going to really want to, you know, have memories of it or be like, oh, remember when, and watch a show that's based about it. Maybe I'm off.
Well, I guess it depends on.
It's not like 9/11 that was such a moment of like coming. I don't know. It feels different to me. That feels like a show would come out of it because of just the nation coming together and mm-hmm. that whole experience. This doesn't feel, I don't know. Right now, this doesn't feel like that to me, but.
Yeah, I mean, like...
Well, this is also ongoing. You know, 9/11 was kind of a one-time thing that had, you know, ramifications. And I thought Rescue Me was a great show that came out only a few years later. It was pretty ballsy, typically ballsy of Tolan to take it on. But it's a little harder with coronavirus because it's kind of ongoing. And even once things start to go back to normal, it's still going to continue to be, you know, evolving, I think, in terms of the way people behave. It's not like you can just set it on one day and... You know.
No, and that's what's fascinating is this isn't going away. This isn't going away. It may just flatten enough where we can all go back to work and go out again. But if it's like if it turns into a yearly kind of like the flu, it turns into like a yearly virus, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Michael. You were gonna say
something. I think if there's gonna be I suspect if there's like a new sort of sub-genre that emerges, in the next 5 years in terms of comedies, it won't necessarily be the coronavirus specifically or pandemic specifically. I think I think the idea is like living in a decaying world, you know, where cultural and economic and physical structures are kind of changing in a way that's threatening people. You know, I think if that's going to be the genre as opposed to specific about, you know, a virus, because I just don't think you can keep the barbarians outside the gates anymore. You know, there's just so much going on. There's that is really going to change what it means to be a human being in the next, you know, 50 years that, and it's really here. It's arriving. And I think coronavirus is the first guest at the party to arrive, you know, but I think there's more coming. And so I think that's really what the change will be, as opposed to specifically a flood of coronavirus shows.
Yeah, I'm curious because Hillary and I do a little bit of what you do, Michael, and then I also do a bit of what Bruce does, which is we write and produce content. But then I do interviews also on the side just because I really love doing this show. And I would imagine Bruce would probably agree everybody's available for an interview right now. It's not hard for me to
book. They are and they aren't. I mean,
really?
It's weird. I mean, they are, but at the same time, like, people don't have as, I mean, especially with movies, it's just there's nothing coming out. You know, I'm glad that I write about TV as well as movies, because I've just shifted over to writing about TV at this point.
Yeah, that's
true. But, you know, people are kind of holding off because they want to promote things that aren't coming out yet, and people don't want to seem like they're being insensitive and, you know, like promoting something during a, you know, pandemic. So it's a little bit of a weird thing, but people are starting to come out again. I think at first it was a little bit more, you know,
we're getting
touch and go with trying to.
We're getting pitched a ton of people, and it's not hard to book people right now for us. I mean, we're also not trying to interview Denzel, but so that's on one side.
Right.
On the other side, you have Michael Whitehorn, who's a sitcom writer. I wouldn't even just say sitcom writer. You write all the time. And we talked to Peter Tolan, and we talked to Alan Loeb, and we've talked to Mark Pellington and Rachel Axler. And Rachel's actually back to work on an HBO show right now. She's actually in a virtual writer's room writing a show. However, the overall sense we get, and I think Hillary and I would agree with this too, is we're planting seeds for things we could do, but it's really hard to have a real meeting right now. They're all kind of bullshit to a degree. It's just like people sitting around talking. What's your experience been, Mike, when it comes to work?
I haven't been, you know, I just a couple of months ago finished the spec screenplay. My next thing I want to try to do is get it made. I wrote it as a made for streamer comedy, but just because of where my head is or whatever, came out a little more indie than that. So I don't know if I maybe missed the bullseye of what Netflix original comedy like Wine Country or the Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston thing. You know what I mean? I was trying to do sort of a smart version of that kind of stuff, but this is more melancholy than they probably got. You know, so I don't know, but anyway, to answer your question, I want to try to get it going, and I've had some conversations with some people, but I confirm what you're saying. It doesn't really feel like, you know, one agent that I was talking to was just like, well, I'm sorry I didn't get back to you in 3 days, but I thought I had coronavirus, you know what I mean? So, I mean, it's, okay, under the circumstances, I'll let that go. But, I do share that it's, and I've been working, you know, I don't know if you know Mitch Hurwitz, but I've been, you know, he and I have been working with, you know, trying to knock out some ideas just because he just made a deal with CBS. And so, you know, we've always wanted to collaborate on something that we tried something a few years ago that fell into the black pit that was Les Moonves at CBS. And
yikes.
But after a few of these Zoom sessions, I wrote to him and I said, man, I know you're on this deal and you got to get something going. You can't fuck around forever. And I just feel like I'm dragging you down. I feel creatively totally empty and dead. And he wrote me back on, you feel creatively empty and dead? I thought I was the one, you know? And then we sort of both blamed it on, Zoom.
It's true. It is.
I think that is a big part of it. It just can't recreate the same energy of, you know, whether it's a creative meeting or a business meeting. So yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, you can't, and it feels awkward selling something on Zoom or on the phone, like pitching, and it's just very awkward. Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're really, really close with your writing partner, like my writing partner, Siobhan Tuck, and I, we've written something together, and we're close, so it's a little easier for us to sit on the phone. We'd rather not. A little easier for us to sit on the phone and toss ideas, but, I mean, we're also in a situation now where it's like, I have to write and then I'll send it to you, and then you gotta write and then you send it to me, and we never get in the same room right now, so that's difficult too. We were talking to Mike McGrail though, and he was saying the same thing. It's just like these Zoom conference calls, and everyone's just kind of like, we're doing this because it's work and we have to, but we're not too sure what the future is going to be, so no one's committing to anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no one can, because nobody knows when things are going to go back to some sense of normalcy that you can actually get people, enough people together to shoot a real TV show, a real movie, and not just these kind of like, you know, iPhone things they're doing for the late night shows, or, you know, it's there's going to be some kind of wall that we hit at some point where content is just going to kind of come to a trickle, because nothing's getting made for months now.
That's what we're hearing, Bruce. So we sold a TV show to Beacon Pictures earlier this year, Hillary and I, and you know, I talked to the boss over there quite often, and he's running our show and pitching it around town. And, you know, he basically said to me what we've been hearing otherwise, which is everyone's accessible and everyone wants to talk, but no one's committing to anything. However, that being said, everyone's running out of content. And there's going to be a lot of sales come July, August. They're just going to just happen. The thing people are worried about, and especially people like Hillary and I that aren't as established, is, well, and Mike, you could speak to this, is we feel a little fear that it's going to be very easy for the networks and cable companies and streamers to go back to the familiar names that maybe they've turned down their projects before, and they're just going to pick them up instead of taking the time to curate and go through new material, because that may be harder. It may take longer to do. Do you think that's possibly going to happen when this is over? Just, you know, pick up every Aaron Sorkin show that we turn down?
You know, honestly, I have long since passed the point where I understand the television business, or what you would call the television business today.
Yeah.
I really don't. You know, when I was, you know, in the 80s, 90s, I said, okay, you know, it's a hard business, and, you know, you win and you lose and whatever, but I knew, okay, there's four networks, and this is what they buy, and this is what they don't, and this is how you navigate it, and I kind of understood the business I was in, and now, you know, with the stratification of it, I did pretty well, I have batting average, selling things to network when I was doing that, but in the digital world, I'm 0 for whatever, however many times I've tried, probably 5 or 6 things. And I'm, you know, so, and they also, you know, I go in there and they go, oh, we love you. It's a big fan of your work, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, it means nothing. You know, there's an agenda at every place you go. There was a staff meeting where they said, go, you know, they dispatch people to go buy this, whatever this is. And if somebody walks in with this, and I, you know, so it's not about the person or their resume or their proven ability to execute. At least that's been my experience so far. Now you're asking, will that change? And I don't know. I have no idea. And I don't think anybody knows.
No.
I think right now there's no playbook. It's just like, you know, these guys are having Zoom meetings with each other. And what the fuck do we do? You know, do we pick up Aaron Sorkin's show that we passed on, or do we, you know, they're asking the same question you are, and probably without real certainty about what the way to go is.
Go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to ask, I don't know if any of you know, I'm just curious whether the networks, you know, I mean, the cable digital are not seasonal, but the networks are, and they're not, this is when they shoot all their pilots and nobody, you know, so what are they going to do next fall? What are they going to put on the air? They're not going to have any new material at all.
Yeah. I that's,
has anyone heard about what the plan is?
I have no idea.
Well,
yeah.
I've talked to everyone. A lot of, go ahead, Bruce.
I said, I think it's going to be a lot of reality, probably.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of cheap to produce stuff you can churn out quickly, game shows and, you know, stuff like that. Because I just don't think they're going to have time to develop series and have enough in the pipeline to, you know, put them on the air and then be able to keep them on the air every week.
It'll also be cheap to produce series when we do come back online, I think. I think cheap and easy is going to win the day over expensive and involved, at least out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very fair. I was wondering, my kind of a follow-up to what we were talking about a moment ago, I think you said there's no playbook, and I think that's correct. In my mind, could the closest thing to a playbook possibly be after the 2008 writer's strike, when the writers went back to work and the networks, you know, because they had to order a lot of content right away. Would you say a situation like the writer's strike where the business shut down basically for a few months? Obviously, this is more extreme, but new content shut down for a few months and then we went back to work.
Yeah.
Can we expect probably something similar to that?
I don't know. I mean, that's a great example, and I think probably that is the closest thing to a playbook. But, you know, I don't know. I just you're asking me questions that require savvy about the business side of the TV business, which I have always lacked, chronically lacked. So I just don't know. I really don't. I feel like you guys probably have a better idea about that than I do.
Unfortunately, I think we have a decent idea about it. It's difficult, though. You're better off not having savvy about it. I'll tell you that, Mike. It's a headache. Does interest me is, and I'm sure this will be interesting for Bruce too. You brought up how you're trying to start a show that kind of died under the Les Moonves regime. And I talked to Phil Rosenthal a while ago, and Phil said to me that no matter how successful Raymond was, he could not get another show going. And that included with Les Moonves. Was there kind of a feeling at CBS that after King of Queens and Raymond, like, why wouldn't they go back to you and Phil for another show?
You know, I honestly don't. That's, again, my lack of insight into what goes on there. I mean, the King of Queens, an important little piece of its history, I think, in terms of why it got on and in the first place, it was developed at NBC, where and I probably told you this story before. You know, Kevin James had a deal there when they used to make these holding deals with comics, and I was one of several scripts they developed for him. And they didn't. Warren Littlefield didn't even want to do it, but it was one Kevin insisted he wanted to do of the several that were developed. But then Warren wanted to turn it into some mush, you know, like he did everything, my agent, Beth Huffner, was sort of engineered getting it out of NBC and over to CBS, who at the time was that year was trying to develop, similar kinds of tonally similar kinds of shows to Raymond to go on Monday nights. And I think Les, given his intensely competitive nature, one of the most competitive people I've ever had any association with, loved the idea that he could take this good script away from NBC and probably was higher and on the project than he would have been had it been developed internally over there. So it's just one of those, like, there were about half a dozen things involved with the King of Queens that were just pure dumb luck that helped it not fall into the abyss that most projects do when they're developed.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce.
That speaks to something that we heard the other week from a producer, Sunil Prakash, who said that Hollywood is built on buzz and FOMO. And if you can capitalize on those two things, then you can have momentum and move forward. So I think that FOMO, that competitiveness and wanting to steal and not miss out on that thing and have that win, really drove that project. So that's interesting to hear.
But see, I've always been interested because of the same thing. You would think you don't want Michael Whitehorn or Phil Rosenthal to go make a show at another network. So for me, it was like equally like, I was very confused when Phil told me this story. Like, I think I was at his house when he told me this. His house is like a $20 million home. And you're like, okay, so someone does not want to hire you. Like, it was so difficult to hear. This is what Michael's talking about with, like, the business savvy. There is no business savvy. It makes no sense. There's nothing. There's no playbooks. There's, you know, it's crazy. It's crazy.
I think Michael, you need to
CBS.
Go ahead, Michael.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bruce. I was going to say CBS was.
Sorry. you guys got the same number of words out twice. It was so perfect. Right.
You two are way too polite. Right.
The last thing I did was they came to me with there's this English sitcom that's wildly successful called Friday Night Dinner about this family. The two boys are grown. They're in their 20s and they go to the parents' house for dinner every Friday night. And the show is it's a huge, huge show in England. And at first NBC, I think, bought the rights to it to develop it. And I think maybe Greg Daniels, uh-huh. I'm remembering, did a pilot that they didn't buy. And then CBS got the rights. So I get a call from CBS. Do you want to develop, try to do an American version of the show? I said, yeah, I really actually like the English show very much. Dan O'Shannon and I wrote a pilot that we thought was really good. And everyone at CBS, below Les, really loved it or whatever. And it finally went to Les. And for whatever reasons, he just, whatever. And it was just bizarre to have been minding my own business. This is kind of like Phil said, if he proactively went to them or something. I was just minding my own business and they came to me to develop a show that they had the rights to. And I was somebody that they had been in business successfully with before. It seemed, and I remember one of the reasons I said yes was I thought, well, I'm ambivalent about doing another show, or going into development again. But this one's a slam dunk to get on the air because they came to me with it's something they bought and they want to develop, and I've worked with them before, so this can't miss. I'm on the air with this, and then when it wasn't picked up, I realized I really didn't know anything. Even if for a moment I thought I had known something, I now realize I knew nothing. So yeah, it makes no sense. Then I look at the stuff I do buy, and it's just sort of aggressively dumb for the most part, which may actually be the game plan. It may just be a conscious effort to really program down to people, and they know they're only going to get like whatever a 0.9 share on their sitcoms, and they're just happy to get that. I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obvious.
Well, go
ahead, Bruce.
I was going to say, I think the answer here is you look at Larry David and you look at Phil Rosenthal, they had to put themselves in their shows. I think, Michael, you have to put yourself in your own show. I want to see the Michael Whitehorn show. You've got the most adorable little daughter. She could steal the show every week.
She could have a show.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I thought there are people that do these YouTube channels with their kids reviewing toys, and the most successful ones have zillions of hits. My kid is actually has a good personality for that, but my wife said absolutely not.
You've been fortunate enough to watch all those toy shows on YouTube. What did Liam watch all the time? Ryan's Toy Review or whatever, and it's like a 7-year-old who reviews toys, and I'm like, wow, okay, that's a thing. And then I found out he's worth millions of dollars from it. Millions.
Wow.
I'm
of course
like,
he is.
Yeah, I got in the wrong business. Wow. Okay. Okay, so we pretty much have decided none of us know anything about the business. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen after this. Here's something I'm curious about. I've talked about with Bruce is what are you currently watching right now, Michael? You got all this time just to be at home. I know you got a daughter and you're a busy man, but do you have more time for TV and what are you watching?
There isn't as much as I'd like because of this fucking kid I got, who's wants to be fed and clothed and paid attention to. No, but I have to say, I love my daughter so much. She's so sweet. I have a 4-year-old. But I'm envious of my friends who are, isolating during this time without kids. I just
Me
did
too.
9 shows yesterday.
Me too.
Damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, you binge a little one. You binged nine shows, but they were all cartoons and
exactly. I don't watched the Winnie the Pooh Christmas today. That was my day.
Right, that's what I'm saying. And by the way, I'm sure Michael, you're probably the same way, and Bruce, you don't got to worry about this anymore. But like, you know, at 9 p.m. when I put Liam to sleep, I have these imaginations that I'm gonna like stay up and watch an R-rated movie or watch that TV show I want to watch, and then I fall asleep while putting him to sleep, and it's just it never happens. It's not happening. I have not binged anything yet. I'm sure it's similar for you. It's just you want to make this time. It's hard. Are you doing homeschooling?
Well, she's in preschool, so
yeah, yeah. I think four
a couple of crayons at her. Here, go to town. You know.
I wish it was that easy. Oh, I just did.
Matt, you're screwed.
Oh yeah, no. Second grade sucks. It's the worst. I'm retaking second grade right now, and it's
well, Billy Madison, you're living it in your real life.
Exactly. Where's the swan, Matt? Where's the swan?
It's and that's like 4 hours of your day, and I'm like, I'm exhausted after homeschool. It's too much. So
no, it's hard.
Michael has no recommendations. He's not watching anything.
My wife hadn't ever seen The Sopranos.
Oh,
I'd seen it when it was first, you know, in real time when it was on.
Yeah.
So I said we got to watch it. So we actually just finished binging. I wouldn't say binging. We're like middle-aged people binging, which is, you know, one episode a night if you're lucky. But we got through the whole series, which I will say for any of you guys or anyone listening to this, if you haven't seen it since its original run. And it's a long enough time since then that like me, you've probably forgotten a lot of the particulars. So you can, in some very real sense, experience it as a new show.
Yeah.
And it is undoubtedly one of the best. I wouldn't fight with anyone who said it was the best.
Yeah.
You know, drama in television history. It's just mind-blowingly good. And other than people walking around talking on landlines all the time, it's like it could be made today. You know, it's very, very contemporary feeling. And the nuances, you know, I just want to kind of watch the whole thing again. There's just so much in there. And I went on the AV club and all these things, you know. I don't know, Bruce, if you wrote about it at the time, but
I did. I did recaps for EW.
And I should go read your stuff. Cause I just was fascinated to just kind of keep my head in it after each episode. I wasn't ready to be done with the experience of having watched it. It was so great. So, you know, I have new stuff. We watched the Tiger King thing. You know, I don't know. It's just kind of.
I can't watch. I can't watch that.
I can't watch it either.
First, when I get past the dumbness of it all, he's so abusive. He's so abusive to these animals. I mean, you cannot get mad that Michael Vick had dog fighting and abuse these dogs and then celebrate this man like he's some kind of anti-hero. He's a piece of shit. And it was like, I couldn't watch it. Lenny tried to sell me on it. A bunch of people tried to sell me on it. And I'm like, I talked to Lisa Guerrero and she did a story on him years ago. And she said when she did the story on him, all these baby tigers or whatever are lying around just abused. They're just like malnourished, not getting taken care of. He didn't care. Their cages were filthy. I'm like, this guy, who cares? But what I do love that Michael said was about Sopranos, he does something that I do. When I go and I rewatch a show or I binge through a show like Barry, I love Barry, or something like that, before I take the next episode, I literally have to read everything that was written about that episode on the internet. I feel like I'm having a conversation with other people, even though I'm not. No one's talking to me, but I'm reading it and I'm like taking it all in. And I go, ooh, they noticed that, or ooh, I didn't notice that. And I really love doing that with great shows like The Sopranos, which is one of my favorites ever.
Yep.
There was some blog that someone was writing about The Sopranos that I was checking, what they said about this episode and then the next one. And there was one where I had really, really strong feelings. And I started to type a comment. And I realized the last comment before mine was like 2008. You know, it's probably not going to get read. I probably shouldn't waste my time. You know?
He probably doesn't even run that blog anymore. He doesn't even check on it.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Well,
speaking,
oh,
of, speaking of shows that, that hold up well years later, Michael, I've been watching some old episodes of Family Ties.
Oh,
so from the first season.
Yes.
And they're amazing. That was a great show. I mean,
really holds
I watched
up.
An episode, I don't know if you remember this one, where Mallory got basically sexually, you know, harassed by a coworker, her father's at the PBS telephone. And it was fantastic. It was like, you know, right on in terms of like even sexual politics and everything. And this was like a network show in the '80s, you know, and I was so impressed by how well you guys handled like serious material in the sitcom format. It was still, you know, a funny episode with, you know, good jokes, but, and it wasn't preachy about it, but it was just like, you know, smart and sophisticated. And I'm like, where is that in network television anymore? Like you don't see that on network sitcoms. So kudos to you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a lot of Family Ties lately. When I caught pieces, I cringe a little at the, I don't know, I feel the jokes feel very, but I'm not able to look at it objectively, you know, it's really great to hear you say that. I'm glad it holds up, that there's something there that endures even as we've outgrown that kind of look and rhythm of shows, that at least there's something in there that doesn't feel like its time has completely passed. So it's nice to hear. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it absolutely holds up. I love Family Ties. That's one of my favorite shows ever. And that, and then, of course, you worked on Cheers, which Cheers holds up. Like, every joke on every episode, I don't know, I laugh at Cheers out loud. Like, I've gotten to that point where I watch so much comedy that I don't do that, like, out loud laugh anymore. I do a lot of, that's funny, that's funny. A Curb, I laugh out loud sometimes. The John Hamm episode, I was dying.
That was a great episode. Yeah.
Oh yeah, but Cheers, and even that we're talking 83 to what 94, and I just laugh so much. It hasn't aged one bit, that show.
Yeah, it was a great show. I only wrote one episode.
Yeah.
By the way. I was not on staff. Well, it was exactly concurrent with Family Ties. We began the same year, but I was a huge fan of the first season of Family Ties and Cheers. I watched Cheers and loved it. And we actually were both on the Paramount lot. So we would interact with those, you know, Ken Levine and, you know, and all the people on that show. You know, we were all friendly with each other and played basketball and stuff. And I was a huge fan of Cheers. I actually, you know, like kind of, there were moments where I felt like, oh, I wish I had done that show. No, but I love Family Guys. But it was, but Cheers to me was like doing a kind of thing. We weren't, you know, it was an adult, you know, it was, and so I, in the hiatus between first and second season of both shows, I approached Glenn and Les Charles to see if they'd be willing to have me, you know, pitch some ideas, and if they like one, give me a freelance episode. So that's how I wound up doing the one episode.
That's so awesome.
That was early in the second season, and it was so great to have that chance.
Yeah, it's so great.
Bostonian, thank you, Michael, for sure.
Yeah, Hillary.
This Bostonian is a very big fan of Cheers. Grew up watching Cheers. My dad went to the original, the Bull and Finch pub. He spent his bachelorhood going to the actual Cheers. So yes, in my family, we love Cheers. So
it was great, monumental show.
I was gonna say, we were talking about how, you know, there's not a lot of adult smart sitcoms nowadays, and the only two I could think of, you know, ABC had The Middle for a while, which I thought was really underrated. Mm-hmm. I feel like I feel like they do a decent job with the Conners. I think Blackish is pretty good.
Blackish is great.
Yeah, and I wish they took as much risk and as much care as they do with Blackish with every other type of sitcom. It seems like they're like, oh, this is edgy because it's going to be like about a black family. And the edginess of it is, it's about adult issues. It's about real things that happen in real life. It's not stupid comedy. I think that gets lost on people. I think people see the outside of it, and they're like, oh, that's what makes it edgy. It's diverse. But that's not what makes it edgy to me. That's not what gives it its edge. That's not what makes it pop. But I wanted to say, yeah, Black-ish. I used to love The Middle. Those were the type of shows that, like, they should be doing right now.
Well, yeah, definitely of the networks. I mean, ABC has the most, you know, sophisticated stuff, but that's not saying a whole lot.
No.
Compared to what's, especially on CBS right now, it's just, oh, God, it's just a wasteland.
The bar's low.
I mean, when you think about what...
It really is.
Yeah, it's low.
Just, it really is. You know, I think it's always the showrunner, you know, the creative team that's making a show. And I there are exceptions, I'm sure, but the network, I think, given their, they're always drag kicking and screaming when a showrunner kind of strong enough to make a show have a voice that is more intelligent and topical and so on. You know, I think they would just totally play it safe, you know, dumb everything down, just shave off the sharp edges if given their druthers. I mean, that seems to really be the case in my experience. So I wouldn't credit the network. I think they, and I'm not going to be wrong. And if so, I apologize to all the ABC executives, Erlen. But I'm blanking on the name of the guy who's created Black.
Kenya Barris.
Oh, Kenya Barris.
Kenya.
Yeah.
So I think usually that's something that just kind of is forced. You know, Seinfeld is the famous story, which you guys probably know better than I know. It's basically one of these things where it just sort of slipped through some doors that somebody had left open, kind of a thing, as opposed to anybody proactively trying to develop a show that had a very, very different, more cynical feel than your standard sitcom.
Yeah.
That feels true today as well.
I have not. I wanted to tell you, Bruce, I'm all caught up on Curb except the season finale. I've not watched
season.
Yeah, well, like I said, I watch it when I can, and I have not had 30 fucking minutes to watch the season finale in like a week, which is blowing my mind. Michael, do you watch Curb?
Okay. I do. I watched the first few this year and then kind of drifted away.
Yeah.
Larry David to me is a real, as a writer, as a man conceptualizes comedic ideas and tone, he's one of the true giants. I mean, Seinfeld and Curb, I just don't like him as a performer, and I never have. And I understand that's kind of part of the joke is sort of amateurishness and all of that, but I've never gotten that joke. I really haven't. You know, when he does, particularly when he does these, one man sort of comedic set pieces, these bits, these sort of, you know, extreme mugging and whatever. And to me, it feels like, you know, like your uncle is telling you about a funny thing he saw someone do on TV and he's trying to recreate it for you. You know, all right, I don't get the idea. You know,
no,
you're
he's
not doing it very
he's,
well.
He's
and that's sort of my experience of him.
Yeah, he's absolutely a terrible actor. I think I actually argued with Bruce about this. Bruce, didn't you like Whatever Works? The Woody Allen movie he did?
I did. I actually did.
Yeah, I hated it. I think you and I got into an argument about it. And I'm just like, who would put Larry David in anything where he plays someone other than Larry David who, I mean, even when he plays Larry David, he's not really, you know, it's not like a great performance of acting. It was so weird to see him in a Woody Allen thing.
It worked for me. I don't know. I mean, it just... It's, I could, you know,
you know,
Woody
what
Allen basically writes himself for every
that's
character.
True.
So.
That's true. You know what you were disagreed with yesterday is we were talking to Tolan and, he loves Succession. He loves it. He thinks it's the greatest show ever.
Bruce. I love it.
I don't dislike it. I just gave up on it too early. I mean, I watched a few episodes and I just didn't care enough about the characters. I haven't stuck with it, but I believe that. People tell me it's good. No, just,
I mean, you and I
had that time to go back to it.
You and I talked about it. I don't know if you've seen it yet, Michael, but Succession, I think, is maybe the most well-written show on TV, except And you and I talked about this, Bruce. It's about rich people getting away with basically murder. And I, in this environment, with this president, in this country, it's cringe-inducing for me to watch something like that right now. I cannot enjoy something like that. I don't find the humor in it. Even though I recognize it's really well-written and funny, I don't personally, I'm like, this isn't funny right now to me. I'm just tired of watching bad people do bad things and get away with it. And it's also, and this is just a personal preference, but it's even worse when it's a comedy for me. I'm over it.
Yeah, no, I mean, we were talking, we feel the same way about Billions, you know? It's like,
yeah, Billions,
I watched the first couple seasons, and finally it was like, I don't care about these people. I don't care about their problems. I don't identify with them. You know, it's a well-written show. It's a well-acted show to some extent. I think Damian Lewis is miscast, but Giamatti's great. But I mean, I can't, it doesn't engage me emotionally because the stakes are just so different from, you know, even my life. And I'm pretty privileged, you know.
I can't deal with the rich New Yorker anti-hero right now. That's not my thing. Michael, what's your take on Succession?
I love it. I really just got totally drawn into it. Thought it was really, really great viewing. You know, soap opera, but a really, really well done one.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I noticed, I guess this was, you know, it's one thing to have sort of a sit in a writer's room and have a concept and say, well, you know, like one of the things I imagine that was said in the writer's room in that show is, you know, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to show that even having insane wealth and power, these people are still miserable. And you can say that and say that's an interesting idea that money, you know, billions don't buy any sort of happiness. But to execute it in a way that yet when you're watching it, you actually feel it viscerally to be true. And I think that's what that show does brilliantly. And I remember what's still resonating with me is that finale of the last season, you know, on that yacht, and which was an amazingly entertaining episode of television, I thought. But that idea that these people are on this fucking yacht with people serving them, this whole staff and a beautiful setting, and they're all just like, their bodies are filled with bile and sadness. And they just, between the writing and the acting, it was just so credible. And you felt it, and I just thought that was a really nice, you know, thing they pulled off there. In addition to being entertaining, they kind of brought their point home in a very, you know, sometimes you can see when you watch something, say, okay, I get what they're going for here, and intellectually I understand the point they're trying to make, but you're not feeling it. For whatever reason, it wasn't written, or it wasn't acted in the right way, or the combination of the two, that you're just not quite on board emotionally, but this, I thought they really pulled it off.
That's interesting. I mean, maybe there'll be a period of time where maybe after this president's out of office, I can enjoy something like that a little more than I am. I mean, I recognize the great acting and writing in it. It's just, I just get angry every time I watch it. I get angry. Hill, what were you going to say?
Yeah.
Matt. I was going to say to me, I'm with Michael. I absolutely love it. But I think to me, it's like the ridiculousness of like King Lear meets like the desperation of Mad World. Like I just think the mashup of like the dark comedy with like what he's saying, that the sheer misery of this family that we can all relate to on some level with family drama. I just love it. I eat it up. I love the darkness.
I mean,
of it,
you should.
That's just my dark little soul.
Hill, you should work for Adam McKay because that was a brilliant elevator pitch right there. King Lear meets Mad World. Got my interest. Please, Michael.
One other thing Succession does really well, they pull off that is hard, is that a lot of times a show will have a character who, in the universe of the show, is funny, like the other people acknowledge this is a funny person, but then the lines that are actually written for that character that other people presumably find funny are not funny, and it kind of undermines the whole thing. But in this show, the Kieran Culkin character is written as a witty guy, but the lines are actually great. They're really, really And so he's loads of fun to watch just by himself. He's
always been a pretty good actor. He's always been pretty good. I like him as an actor a lot. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, obviously, I don't think any of us really have much to promote right now, other than you can watch Landline on Amazon Prime. Bruce, you got your article in the Times today with Modern Family. If you want a quick read, it's on the internet. And then, Michael, you got anything you need to plug?
I got nothing. I do want to say though, as you know, to an audience, I don't know if I hope I've said this to you before, Bruce, but I'll say it again. I'll say it for the first time. You know, when we were doing the King of Queens, you know, not to sort of complain about being in a successful situation, but it was frustrating because we felt like we were doing a show that was sort of creatively on a par with the other contemporary sort of, you know, smart quote unquote comedies of the day. You know, Raymond and Friends was still on and Flatter on. And we never got any acknowledgement for that in the press or in anything. And I said, man, am I crazy? And it was like one guy out there who got it before I even met him. I said, this guy, Bruce Fretz in Entertainment Weekly. He writes things about Stargate. This guy gets it. And and it was hugely morale building for me and for the writing staff, Bruce.
No, that's great.
During those early years of the show, when you were a supporter.
Well, thanks. Well, yeah, I've always sort of prided myself on trying to, you know, be a champion for the underdog, and that's why I tend not to watch things like Succession and Tiger King. When everyone's telling me it's great, I'm like, fine, okay, let me find something that nobody is saying is great that actually is great, and tell people about it. That's always what I wanted to do as a critic. And, you know, with awesome. Raymond, when it started out, with King of Queens, you know, with News Radio, there were certain shows that I just felt like were great shows that for whatever reason just didn't get the respect they deserved, didn't get the nominations, didn't, you know, get the, they weren't the cool shows for whatever reason, but they were just as good. And I always made a point to try to turn people onto those shows. And I think, you know, time has
you have a great
proven
eye in
that,
general.
You know, some of these
I
shows
mean,
really hold up well.
Yeah, I mean, you have a great eye in general, and when you were doing movie reviews, are you still posting those? I remember...
sometimes, yeah, not as much as they used to, but yeah.
And I just, like, you know, you were always right on the money, particularly, like, when it was going against the conventional wisdom. You know, when you liked the movie that most people didn't, or vice versa. I would say, yes, you know. Really, it was. You have a very keen eye for things that are not, you know, to not simply, you know, go that route of the, you know, like, well, this is, you know, everybody's saying this is great, so it must be great kind of thing. I mean, you're much more kind of sophisticated and nuanced eye than most people who do what you do.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I learned it growing up reading Tom Shales in the Washington Post, who was always kind of a bit of a contrarian. You know, and it would always kind of open my eyes when I would see him say something that kind of went against the herd mentality. And so I've always tried to sort of keep that, you know, radar to, you know, well, okay, everyone's saying this, but is it really good? Or everyone's not talking about this, why not? You know, and just try to, like, be, you know, the advocate for the, you know, the little shows that really deserve, you know, the attention that they might not be getting. It's a little harder now. I mean, I think, especially in the Rotten Tomatoes universe, you know, everyone just looks at the percentage and nobody reads their reviews anymore. But I still try to rail against that mentality and just, you know, I really feel like every critic has to have their own, you know, taste, and the relationship that a reader should have with a critic should be like, you know, you read them over a period of time, you get to know them, their personality, and then you can gauge, you know, against, well, I know he tends to like these kind of movies or doesn't like these. And, you know, I certainly have my blind spots, and Matt and I have talked about the fact that, you know, I don't really do science fiction or fantasy. No. I don't really do animation, you know. But, you know, people hopefully over a period of time, if they read you, get to know that and can kind of, you know, acknowledge that and you know, just get to know the person. And it's just one person's opinion. But, you know, if you have, like, a consistent kind of aesthetic, and my aesthetic is realism, you know, I always want, whether it's comedies or dramas, it to be based in some kind of emotional reality, like you were talking about earlier. And so sometimes shows that are a little too over the top aren't for me, you know, but, you know, I just want to relate to the characters. I just want to feel some kind of, you know, connection. And that's why sometimes it's hard for me to, you know, watch shows about rich people or dragons or, you know, things that just aren't part of my universe. But, you know, I think that's a good sort of baseline. It's like, does this feel real in a way? You know, is this, mm-hmm. is this grounded in some kind of emotional, you know, reality, you know? And I think it's even with all the different outlets and streaming and cable and Quibi and, you know, all these things that are going on, that's still what I'm always looking for. And that's what I loved about The King of Queens, is that it felt real to me, you know, like these characters. Yeah, it was a sitcom and it had a laugh track and there was a certain, you know, format to
very
it. But
real, very real.
It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the characters were real. You felt like you knew them. You felt like you believed that they, you know, had these relationships with each other. And that's what I loved about the show, is that it was not pretentious or over the top in any way. It was just, you know, really well made, really well written, really well acted. And, you know, it wasn't hip or cool. It wasn't the beautiful people kind of show, but so what? It's great. And people still watch it. You know, it still does really well.
It's interesting because Bruce kind of brought us all together, because my admiration for Bruce and my admiration for Michael got me to hit up Michael to do the podcast when we were very, very early. And Michael was generous enough to do it very, very early. And Bruce would come on and do it with me. And the thing that I've learned from Michael and Bruce, especially Bruce, because Michael, I know, has too many people that hit him up to do this, but I don't know if Hillary knows this even. Every time I write a script, the first person I send it to is Bruce. Because if Bruce likes it, it's not that it doesn't maybe even need work, but I know I'm on to something, and I know it's grounded in reality. If Bruce doesn't like it, if Bruce doesn't like it, I probably would move on from it. Yeah, so I mean,
Bruce, and I tell you the truth too. I mean, you've sent me things that I didn't like because I felt like they were too jokey or too, you know, like that I didn't. But I feel like every time you send me a script, it gets better and better, and it gets realer and realer. And you're really, you know, I just am so impressed by how you've developed as a writer. And I, you know.
Well, thanks, Bruce.
It's
Bruce, I think you and I have the same sensibility. I think I give Matt the same notes as you.
Yeah, and by the way,
grounded,
the script you guys wrote together, I read your guys' script and thought it was great.
Well, I was going to say, let's give Bruce credit for sitting through all these scripts about 50-year-old lesbians.
Bravo, Bruce. Bravo.
I mean the last pilot that I wrote that I'm in love with, it's my favorite thing I ever did, but I sent it to Bruce, and this is totally not Bruce's demographic, was middle-aged LGBTQ community people and their sex life. And it's a romantic comedy, like hour-long thing, and I'm like, I'm going to send it to Bruce just because I sent it to Bruce. And that Bruce, like, reads it and, like, gets it or doesn't get it, but they read
it.
I'm like, oh, my God, thank you. Because, I mean, obviously not your bread and butter being the the middle-aged lesbian community.
Well, you just want someone to get it, though, like Michael was saying. Like, thank God this reviewer gets it. Like, that's all we want is someone to get it, whether they relate, whether they actually relate to it or actually, like, would watch it or not. You just want them to go, I get what you're doing as an artist. That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Well,
that's special.
You know, there's two things. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Michael. No, go ahead.
But I was just going to say, you know, there's kind of two things. You know, when you write something, particularly something that isn't formulaic, which is kind of its own thing, like your stuff, certainly, you know, Matthew, which I love, by the way. I loved your movie, and I think I told you that at the time.
Thanks, Mike.
But then you put it out in the world, and it's, you know, it doesn't you're not up accepting your Oscar, you know, or Emmy or whatever. You know, it's just good, but you wonder, okay, so what is it me? Did I miss, or did I just do something that hit, but only there were only certain people who have the receptors to kind of get what I was doing? And it's, you know, I've never had a problem with doing something where some people like it, some don't. As long as I feel like I kind of accomplished the thing I was trying to do, and you get enough feedback, like, you know, you were just describing, you know, to make you feel like, okay, I'm not crazy. I did what I meant to do. It's just not for everybody.
Exactly.
And that's a much better feeling than that I just missed. I just didn't pull it off.
Totally.
So,
yeah, I agree.
Listen, I should send you guys my script because
I'm
with a screenplay now.
I want to read it,
Mike. You know I love reading. You know I love reading. Send it over. I love reading other people's work because it distracts me from doing my own. Well, I want to thank you, Mike, and I want to thank you, Bruce, and Hillary, thank you. Thanks for giving us an hour of your time tonight. And then, you know, hopefully when this whole thing's over, you know, Mike will be able to get together in L.A. I'm trying to get out to Jersey one of these days, Bruce.
Yeah, or New York, whatever. You know, come east.
Well,
I miss Chicago, too. I want to come out to Chicago again soon.
You know, I was in the middle of that job offer, and this whole thing kind of froze it. And I'm like, I don't want to take this job. I'd rather sell a pilot or go work on a show or make a movie. But, you know, it's a lot of money. And I'm like, well, the good thing is, if I took this job, I would be near Bruce. I would have a friend that's like 30, 45 minutes away. And now this whole thing kind of paused it, so... maybe that's the universe giving Hillary and I time to get something going in the pilot hemisphere. So hopefully, but I appreciate you guys coming on. Yeah. I appreciate you guys. You're great friends and it means the world to me. Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Hill.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for talking to Mike
and Hillary.
Yeah. Thanks.
And, nice talking to you, Bruce.
All right. Well, let's talk. Let's catch up soon. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye guys.
Bye.
Bye.